entertained. When I enter combat in my Abrams tank, I listen to Metallica. It keeps me in a like I can conquer anything. It brings me back to when I was a boy. A week ago I was in Jersey. Push the button, name on screen. Shoot the moving pixels. Shoot the moving pixels.
So we're listening to a little bit of Soldier Songs, which is by David T. Little, who I am interviewing later on in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I just love that. And I played the entire clip because I got some feedback from a few people saying you should play whole pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we should whenever we're able to, you know. And in this case, we can play a whole track of this, right?
Yeah. And in the interview, I'll play a longer track as well. So just so people can get a better sense of the pieces while we talk about them. So we have a discussion.
This is great.
Yeah, I know. And
it sounds so rock driven. Like, you know, like you were saying earlier, it's got this pulse to it.
Well, he started composing rock, and that was one of his ways into music. But he also studied with a lot of very famous teachers, including Balcom as well. Mm-hmm. Also a Balcom student actually is Jeff Myers, who we interview on this show, and he's the composer of an opera called Marin of Vardo.
Which was also at the Vox Festival that we talked about.
Yeah, and we saw a very early version, so we'll talk to him about the production that's being done right now up at Yale. Actually, both of these are being done up at Yale. Jeff's is this week, and David Little's Soldier's Tale is next week.
Go see it. Yeah, I gotta say, man, Yale is hot since 2000, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Everything cool stuff, cool composers, people are always at Yale. It's like it's lighting up, you know.
And they're both being shown as part of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, which is being done up there over the next few weeks. There's a lot going on there. I think Bang on the Can's playing and. It's not a really
can.
Yeah. One of my favorite groups.
Yeah, they're great.
So have you seen anything lately?
No, I've been really, really busy doing end of the year stuff for my job and stuff. So I have not seen any new operas really lately.
I went and saw Clarence and Anita, and it was good.
Yeah.
It's a little different than, well, I mean, it doesn't hit you the way that a regular opera would. It's actually so pop sounding. You know what I mean? The songs, there's like rumbas, and I guess he's sort of trying to get under your skin in a different way, not through a seriousness, but through just sort of
this.
Yeah, well, it's like a circus atmosphere. Everything was so like crazy. He doesn't get sort of deep with that. He keeps it all in this sort of a poppy public way. It's sort of
it humorous?
I found it humorous.
Okay.
I think it was
supposed to be humorous?
I think, you know, He's an incredibly, Ben Yarmolinsky, he is an incredibly humorous person. When I first met him, my first impression was he has like an imp on the inside.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
This
mischievous imp on the inside. And I mean, he studied with the greats. I mean, he studied in Paris with, what's her name?
Boulanger.
Yeah, Boulanger. He studied with the greats. And then... Mm-hmm. But the music he composes doesn't come from that same place, he actually mixes in all the musical influences of today. So it was just different than I expected. I'm not making a quality judgment, just different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sometimes I think it's okay to say about something that, you know, I just don't know. I just have to kind of sit with it longer or hear it more or something, you know?
The other part that was interesting was the songs that I had heard. When I heard them, I was really glad to hear them. Like, I bet this is the kind of thing I would go back and re-listen to just for fun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's a merit, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they also did Apollo and Daphne first. So they had this Handel piece, and then they had the Yarmolinsky. So that was kind of interesting. And one of my favorite parts was the Handel had these dancers. So there was a singer singing Apollo and a dancer dancing Apollo, and there was a singer uh-huh. singing Daphne and a dancer dancing Daphne.
Oh, like a French ballet chant.
Yeah, and
thing, yeah.
And it was sort of showing, like, you know, he's talking about chasing her, and there's all this aggression, you know, sexual play where he's going after her and she's running away. And then in the middle of the Yarmolinsky piece, when Thomas is talking about, I didn't pursue her, the dancer's mm-hmm. doing the exact same dance. He is in the same costume doing the pursuit dance on the stage.
Oh,
it was very, nice. It was very funny.
Subtext.
It was very funny. And I'm wondering what City Opera's going to do next year.
I don't know. I mean, what do you think about them leaving Lincoln Center? I just don't feel like it's a good idea.
It feels like a bad idea only because I've always known them to be there, you know?
I mean, there might not be another option is what's going on, but...
Right,
you know,
but it could be an opportunity. I mean, they didn't originally want to move in there. And I think that maybe there could be a spot that might even be much better for them, but it's... I just want to know what they're thinking.
Right, right.
It could be good, though. It could... You know, change can be good.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, I'm often impressed by New York City Opera and what they do, even in their most kind of dire situations. They seem to work it out, you know?
Yeah, and I like their goals, so...
Mm-hmm, I do, too.
So we'll keep our eye on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So why don't we actually go to the interview now?
Let's do it.
This is David T. Little, and I interviewed him talking about Soldier Songs.
Excellent.
I wanna be a real American hero. I wanna be just like my toy soldiers. Killing all the bad guys with a funny name. Killing all the bad guys with the funny names.
So I'm talking with David T. Little, the composer of Soldier Songs, which is being done up at Yale on June 23, 24, and 25, just coming up. It's not the first production of this piece. It actually has a long history, and I think that's kind of interesting, and I'd like to talk about that. Not every opera has a single way of finding its way to the stage. Sometimes there's very circuitous routes. How did this start? Where did you get the idea to do an opera about soldiers?
I think the piece initially started by having the opportunity to write something large. In 2004, I won a prize from the Pittsburgh New Music Ensemble, the Harvey Gall Prize. That was for a premiere that would take place two years later in 2006. And I asked Kevin Noe, the artistic director and conductor of the group, and I said, well, can I have the whole show? Can I write a piece that is the entire concert? And he sort of thought about it for, you know, not too long, maybe a few seconds, and said, well, sure. You know, and we came up with a sort of an agreement about what that would mean. You know, it had to be at least, I think, 50 minutes long. It had, you know, there were certain things that he needed for the organization, for PNME. And then I just sort of got going. And I don't know that I had the idea at that point to write a piece about soldiers. I just knew that it was time for me, knowing where I wanted to be in 5 years, knowing that I wanted to be working in theatrical forms and working, you know, writing larger pieces, that I needed to just sort of jump in, and I had this opportunity to do it, and so I sort of seized it.
Is there some sort of personal family connection to soldiering?
There are a lot of family members actually who are involved in the piece. My stepfather, two of my uncles, my grandfather are all interviewed as part of the piece, as well as a number of friends from high school and friends who I met after high school who had very interesting relationships with the military. My generation of my family, not so much, but the previous generations definitely. And going back even further, I mean, my grandmother on my mother's side reports that the earliest ancestors of ours to come over to the then colonies were in the form of Hessians fighting for the British. So we haven't been able to confirm this, you know, with her beyond just her assuring us that it is true. But there is this history of military service in our family. And also, you know, growing up where I grew up, I have a lot of friends. And this is sort of where the piece began for me, is I have a lot of friends who, after high school, went into the military. And my position at the time as a young person regarding the military was very severe and very, sort of unsympathetic. I didn't understand how someone could enlist and how someone could put themselves in these sorts of positions. And yet I found myself with all of these people I deeply cared about making that decision, including members of my family. It really started with that question and saying, well, how do I get to the bottom of this personal question, this sort of situation that I'm experiencing in my own life?
So now the piece seems to be structured in three parts. Basically, mm-hmm. there's childhood conception of what it means to be a soldier. And then there's right. the actual experience of the soldier and then sort of the post-war mm-hmm. experience as well.
Right.
And you didn't work with a lyricist. You found all the, was it found or written by you?
It's a combination of the two. What was interesting about this piece for me in terms of my introduction to opera is I didn't start out to write an opera. And in a lot of ways, you could make an argument that it's not an opera. It's a dramatic cantata or a staged song cycle. I mean, there are a lot of ways that it's been described, and I think they're all appropriate.
That was really interesting. It was very cinematic with voices in the background and lots of great environmental mm-hmm. sounds. Now, which part came from the interview? The little voice in the background?
Yeah, there's a spoken text which discusses the feeling of running from incoming ordnance. And that text comes directly from an email from my friend Justin Bennett, where he talks about that feeling, about what it feels like to hear a missile coming into your base and how you react, how you've been trained to react, but also how you react just as a human being and realizing that, you know, you might not, this might be the last moment of your life, or, you know, all sorts of things go through your head. And there's the moment that he says the thing you want to hear is you want to hear it explode because that means you survived. If you don't hear it explode, it got you, you know.
Right. Now, composition on a piece like that, are the sound effects that we're hearing in parts of video that you've cut in, or is that something that you have a keyboard with sounds? How does that work there?
Yeah, no, those are all samples from a sample library, and I sort of constructed it from the ground up, looking at the structure of sort of, you know, in the structure of the piece that sort of comes from, there's a movement called Hollywood Ending, and Hollywood ending is sort of interrupted by the sort of sound effect stuff at the beginning, and then it kind of settles down into the narrative and then ends with the actual steel rain, which we used in the original performance. We had these giant rain gutters that we poured BBs through, and they poured down to the feet of the audience and had this really great effect of sort of breaking the fourth wall. In this production, in the production since 2008 that we've done, it's been pre-recorded on that track.
Tell us about the performance history now. It was done, how many times has it been done?
Let's see. Well, it was premiered in 2006 by the Pittsburgh New Music Ensemble. And then it kind of sat for a while. In 2007, I met Beth Morrison, who was very interested in the piece. And this is the first project we've done together, and we've done a lot of projects since then. And she, the Beth Morrison Project's production was in 2008 at Le Poisson Rouge in New York. So that was 2008. There was also a performance in Houston. Company Opera Vista did it. There was a concert performance in Washington, D.C. So it's had a nice life. I'm really excited for this performance. This is really the first time ever in a way that it's a really fully staged, full production team, enough tech time kind of situation where it's really the fullest realization of the theatrical conception of the piece.
So they use the same sample. How does that work? You have a score and you send them sound samples, or is the video included, the same video in all the performances?
It's differed. The original performance in Pittsburgh, I had actually done the video. And then the Beth Morrison Project's productions, Corey Michael Smithson has done the video. But then, when it's done in Houston, it's a totally different thing. And when it was done in D.C., that was more of a concert performance. But each sort of company that takes it on brings their own interpretation. But in a certain way, I've kind of let it go out into the world, and it's going to be what it's going to be,
Now, did it turn into the piece you thought it was going to be when you started? How is it related to that?
In some ways, it's the piece that I set out to write in terms of the musical characteristics. Before this piece, I really was very restrictive of myself as a composer, and I wouldn't allow myself to use certain stylistic things that I maybe found natural, but I would resist them because I was a quote-unquote serious composer, and that's not what serious composers do. And this is the first time that I said, I'm going to write a rock song here, and that's going to be okay. Or I'm going to really just go for this reference to Metallica. I decided at the onset that I was going to trust myself entirely. The piece is a result of that process. In terms of the meaning of the piece has evolved very significantly and continued to evolve until 2009. And we did a performance in New York for APAP conference, and after that performance, I said to Beth, I understand now what this piece is about. I get the ending. It's all about PTSD, and it's all about coping with the experience of having been in this situation. And in the earlier versions of the piece, I didn't get that in the same way.
The piece has an amazing array of styles to it. There's that rock style. We have the cinematic style. There's even a spot in the middle that almost sounds like wonderful Japanese flute from Ron. Very, very emotional. I want to play another part that really moved me very deeply when I heard it, just to sort of show the range of where this piece goes. So can I play some of Two Marines?
Sure, yeah.
Answer the door. I knew.
To have a wide range of sounds in your palette and styles in your palette, and you use them very effectively. And I mean, it's so incredibly moving. Writing Two Marines, what were you thinking when you came to that?
Two Marines, I should say, was the first part of this piece that was written, and it was actually written a year before I had the commission to write what became Soldier Songs. It was originally, there's a song cycle. I mentioned earlier that I had written text for a number of pieces, and one of them was a song cycle called Songs of Love, Death, Friends, and Government, which was for soprano, violin, and clarinet. And so this was originally for soprano and was originally a much different kind of very pared down sort of work. And I don't remember if I had said, well, I'm going to write the rest of the piece around Two Marines. So I don't remember how it came to be, but at some point it became clear that it should be in this part of the piece. We should lead to it. In terms of the style question, it's really about what needs to be communicated dramatically, I think. And I think it's a very personal thing. It's a very intuitive thing. It's not the kind of thing where I sit down and say, I'm going to write this kind of music now. It's just I've come to a point now, you know, coming up on 10 years since I sort of made that decision to remain completely open about aesthetic decisions, where it's just has become all very natural and all just a part of how I think of music. You know, it's all there and it all has a different thing to say. And when you want to say that thing, you know, you should feel free to incorporate what you need as a composer, as a crew. I feel like it's important for me, at least, to feel that I can use the tools that are available to me to express what needs to be expressed.
Just tell me a little bit more about this production up at Yale. How did that come about?
So in 2009, we did the sort of concert performance for APAP. I mentioned earlier I had this sort of realization of what the piece was about, and that it was about this experience of what war does to the people who fight it, basically. And realizing that PTSD had such a strong part to play in the piece, we started thinking of what that meant for the piece in terms of its life in the world. And we realized that we wanted to be able to get more involved in veteran communities. We wanted to try to reach people who were having these experiences. You know, one of the things that kept coming up as I was interviewing the veterans is that they had never talked about these experiences with people. You know, my one uncle, Rich, who was in Laos, says, you know, I've never talked about this. And, you know, to be honest, I don't feel comfortable because I just don't want to bring stuff back.
Well,
it's just really powerful.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And the when I listened to the last movement, it sounds gruesome. It's horrific.
But I've never ever talked to anybody about this. You know, so much in my head, it's hard to remember it, you know. And some of it, you don't want to remember this. It's so weird, you know. The munitions that they use, what they do to a human being, you could not comprehend. You'd have to see it to believe it, and I don't think you want to see it to believe it. We lost a lot of people there.
I mean, you can see the ones that didn't make it. If you go to Washington, I count myself as being very lucky.
Or you see something that is so horrendous, you just push it to the back of your mind. You just can't imagine it. You can't believe one human can do that to another human.
So that's the nature of the beast, doesn't it? You go in and you don't know what's going to happen.
Artillery shell falls down between a guy's feet. You know, the only thing that's the only thing you see is the blood dripping off the leaves on the trees.
War is killing.
You know, the smell of
gunpowder.
It's hard to remember a lot of things we did.
Don't follow stupid orders.
When you see all the casualties coming through, the dead, the wounded.
And that's a scary proposition. The horrors of war.
send them home?
From basic training, the first thing and the scariest thing I can remember was the drill sergeant. He happened to be about 6'5", and with his boots and his hat on, he stood about 7 foot tall. And it was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I allowed my wife to shave my head before I went in.
It's a difficult scene. I mean, it's one of these scenes, and Yuval Sharon, who's directing, has really just gone for it. So two things I want to say, though. I want to just make sure to complete the sort of how we got to Arts and Ideas.
Uh-huh.
So Beth Morrison and I just sort of brainstormed about, you know, what sort of a festival or what sort of a venue or a presenter would be interested in a project that involved, as part of the project, this outreach component, you know, that was part of what was really important to the project being successful. And International Festival of Arts and Ideas is exactly that place. I mean, that's what they specialize in. So our involvement with them actually started last summer, where Beth and I went up to New Haven for a panel discussion on PTSD. And we connected with these people afterwards, and they've been very helpful in connecting us here this year with the veteran communities in West Haven and Hartford. And it's tough, you know, it's a difficult piece to see. And I know these family members of mine who were interviewed for it can't really handle it. It just triggers things, you know, especially, you know, Steel Rain. I mean, my one uncle can't even listen to a recording of that, like in his car or on a stereo, let alone being in a space where it has an immersive sort of audio experience.
And does it surprise you how difficult this was going to be?
There were moments when I was writing it where I felt that the things that I was saying were difficult things, you know, and that they were maybe not things that people were going to want, that they were honest in a certain way that was potentially challenging. And there were moments where I had to sort of stop and say, am I going to do that? Am I going to take that next step and go in that direction? And I just time and time again and decided that, yes, I had to. That was sort of my job in that moment. Is to keep going and be as honest as I could with what I had been given, because I felt like these veterans who spoke to me, I mean, they trusted me with this material. You know, they gave me these stories that they had never told to anybody else. I felt like I had to behave responsibly with them, not only in how they were curated and sort of cut together and all of that, but also just in terms of, you know, as my one uncle said, he said, do you want to hear the sugar-coated story or do you want to hear what really happens? Based on their experiences.
So it's interesting to hear that you're liaisoning with the veteran community, because it sounds like a strongly anti-war message, but how do the veterans react to that?
This was something I was very, nervous about early on when the piece first premiered, because I was, in a certain way, I was sort of guessing, you know, I had spoken with these people, but I wasn't there. I'm not a veteran. I've never been a soldier. And so there was this sense of, am I going to, you know, are people going to be really upset by this piece? And for the most part, I think, you know, for every 10, 20 people who feel really positively about it, there's maybe one who has an issue with it. Most people who I encounter who have come to see the piece, they appreciate this honesty that I'm talking about. This, you know, they've said, you got it right. That's exactly what it's like. These guys, not just guys, these men and women get back from these combat situations, and the feeling is that no one can understand what I've gone through.
I don't know if it is possible to
feel.
Yeah,
well, and as a result, they don't feel that they can, A, they're not understood, B, they don't want to try to make you understand, because it's just, you can't. You know, my one uncle, he was dropped from a helicopter into the jungle and surrounded by Viet Cong for 2 hours by himself. There's no way I could really understand what that was like. And so as a result, there's this gap that's created between these men and women who are coming back, who've done these impossibly difficult things, and for reasons that they felt very strongly were the right reasons. And there's this gap that is really hard to get through or get over to other people. For a non-veteran audience, that's sort of what this piece can be about, I think, is going into the situation and just having, like, getting 1% of understanding just how hard it is to do what these people are doing, and to do it without judgment. I mean, I don't think that the piece is anti-war in the sense of, it's not like a protest piece. I don't think of it as a protest piece.
Right.
I think of it as an examination of the realities of the situation. Like, war does something to the people who fight it.
Right.
And And I feel like we need to acknowledge that, and we need to just understand that as citizens. Because if we do, it'll change how we perceive it, you know, and we'll change how we perceive these people.
Yeah, it seems that it's a pro-warrior, anti-war.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Well, it's incredibly generous of them to open up and talk about it.
Yeah, it was really
incredibly
thankful.
Yeah, and risky. Risky emotionally, risky in many ways for them. Right, it's like the bravery doesn't end after the battle. You have to keep living that way. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. It's really wonderful. I just think it's great that you've done this piece, and I hope it's very successful.
Thank you.
So it was really fun talking to him, and it's such a serious subject. And
yeah, there's some dark stuff there.
Yeah, and... once again, it's being done up at Yale, so if you can get up there to see it.
Up to Pistol Wave in New Haven.
Yeah, Pistol Wave in New Haven.
You never heard that?
No, I never heard that.
I just kind of think it's something that you hear and never forget. I don't know if Yale will appreciate that, but that's why we're the Indie Opera Podcast. Right?
Okay, I'm sure we'll get letters, so. About that.
Hey, you know, there's no such thing as bad press.
We're okay. That's what they say. Okay, why don't we listen to the interview that we recorded with Jeff Myers? Mm-hmm. Sure, here he is. So we're here talking with Jeff Myers, who's the composer of Marin of Vardo. So we've heard a bit of Marin of Vardo at Vox this year. And that was in a very early version of it, right? It was still...
That was a collection of scenes and arias that I had composed over the last 3 years that a few of them had been performed on a concert at Joe's Pub and the Canal Room, some kind of showcase concerts that the Coterie had produced.
And now the version that you're doing up at Yale, is this a complete opera or is it still a workshop?
It's basically a complete opera, but it is still in its infancy in a way. I got, from the beginning to the end, and now we have a task at hand where we have to basically rework some scenes that we've reimagined in, I think, more vibrant ways. After getting a lot of feedback from the conductor, Robert Trevino, and the director, Thaddeus Strasburger, we have a lot more kind of exciting ideas to play around with.
So now tell us about the story. What was the inspiration for this?
Royce was looking around on Wikipedia for interesting stories, and he stumbled upon this 17th century Norwegian witch trial that had happened in the uppermost regions of Norway, in Vardo. And he took some confessions that a witch girl had made, under duress, of course. And it was these strange stories about going to hell through a hole in a mountain, visiting Satan, witches being transmogrified into birds, all these kind of crazy tales. And so what he wanted to do was turn this story into a full-length kind of grand romantic opera in which the girl is actually a witch and she actually goes to Satan and falls in love with Satan. Eventually, one of her friends kisses Satan, she gets jealous, and it creates this tension. Act two is the actual interrogation where she's being interrogated by the town priest and she's forced to give up all of her friends. She's being attacked by the priest. Eventually she's branded in the forehead with a hot iron. And after setting up this tension where she's already feeling like Bodil betrayed her for kissing Satan, she gives up Bodil and then she gives up the rest of the girls, Karin and Gunhild, her other witch friends. And then in Act 3, it sort of flashes to the future. Marin was not burned at the stake like her friends were that she told on, and she's slaving away in a workhouse. She's called by her friends, and she goes back into hell the same way she did originally, and she finds all of her friends now, they're brides of Satan, and she wants to very badly to be in this group again. She wants to be a bride of Satan, and they tell her basically, you're not welcome here, go back to heaven, you're punished to heaven or Vardo.
So it seems that a lot of the opera is sort of an inversion of what people would normally expect. And I remember during the Vox that it seemed that the interrogation and the humans seemed to be the least human characters, and that the devil, mm-hmm. the devil was the most humane, caring.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all flipped. So the evil person is the priest who's sort of maniacal and crazy. And then, Satan is actually this kind of stand-up guy.
Now, I'd like to play. We have a clip of Evening Furnace. We played a part of this before in our earlier podcast, but I'd like to play the whole thing. And I just want to say it's really well set up in the piece we saw, where what comes immediately before it, the tonality, all of a sudden resolves to this one moment where everything holds still. And it's very human and passionate. And it, I don't know, it hit me very emotionally. It was actually the only thing in all of Vox that gave me chills. It was a beautiful moment. I'd like to play that, and then we'll discuss it. So give me a second.
Thank you.
So that was Evening Furnace, and Noah has joined the conversation. Hey, Noah.
Hello.
So, hello. So we were just talking about how Mare Novatus is like an inverted structure where the humans are sort of horrible and animalistic, and then Satan seems to be the most human character. And this music that we just heard, Evening Furnace, it's interesting because it sounds like the everything stops at this moment, and the lyrics become very poetic. Was that on purpose?
Well, it's interesting. Royce was actually surprised when I set this and sort of how it came out, because he thought it would be just those couple of lines and it would kind of go by quickly, whereas I turned it into this huge arrival point where it's sort of like a lullaby slash romance, and you just get to sit with this feeling that they're laying down and embracing each other.
Was it a musical decision that you made because of the text, or was it just a...
It was a dramatic one, I think. I mean, I felt like when they were going to do this action, it was something that would take some time. And it was also a nice arrival point musically in the structure up to that moment, because you had a lot of different things happening. It's moving rather fast, so it's nice to kind of like close off a little arc and then set up the next thing. Mm-hmm.
And it seems to sort of be the heart of the whole thing. I mean, this moment is what keeps Marin going for the rest of the opera.
This is the moment that sort of crystallizes their relationship. Exactly. So,
well, what is the interrogation like?
Well, we weren't trying to make it totally
like a period
historically piece. Accurate or something
yeah,
like
right.
that. I mean, we just added some new lines that mentioned crayons and, you know, Wolverines or something like that, which I don't, is probably totally anachronistic or geographically doesn't make sense. Interrogation is in some ways a kind of basic archetype that we're working with, you know, the way you'd imagine maybe even Guantanamo or something, where people are just being tied down and they're being forced to just
confess something,
you know, even if it's a lie, it doesn't matter. They just want something out of them.
But in this case, she actually tells the truth, even though it sounds like it's a lie.
Yeah, you don't want her to tell that truth, because they are actually witches in this scenario. It's not like they were not witches at all and they were, you know, just making this up. And that's actually something that we're kind of playing with, is maybe this is a fantasy. Maybe the whole thing is a fantasy made up by the actual girl who's accused of being a witch, and it's not a witch at all, but she comes up with this elaborate story, and so we watch this play out throughout the whole opera.
So now, having it staged, how has that changed your outlook on the piece? What has it done to it?
Well, actually, it's not being staged here.
Oh, what is it? Well, tell me about it.
It's, I mean, we have a director, and he's helping dramaturgically and stuff like that, but it's pretty much a reading where people have music, and they're reading off book and stuff.
Like an oratorio.
Staging-wise, it's still a little bit malleable. We're having the idea that maybe the other girls are actually there present in some way so that they can hear Marin confessing and doing this stuff, but maybe through a small window, or they're in a cage, so that they're kind of even commenting on, you know, what you're saying, you know, I have nothing to tell you, and they're like laughing and stuff like this.
So do you think that the work necessitates a big space or a small space, or do you have a scale in mind?
We don't have a definite scale in mind, but I do think that it would actually work kind of nice in a smaller space with a small chamber orchestra, something like this.
Is it?
Because in a way, it's not very grandiose in kind of scenery. It can be kind of tight, you know, some small spaces, and, you know, I can see the little area in hell where they inhabit working in a smaller space. And also some of the vocal production, I don't really see it being so huge either. Like, I like some of these intimate vocal sounds.
How big is the piece in general? Are we talking an hour, or how long is this looking now?
Right now it's around a little over an hour and a half. So it could maybe be a little longer, but I don't think it would go over 2 hours.
So if there are any opera companies out there who are interested in picking this show up, you should contact us or go to our website and get through to Jeff. And we would love to see this staged, because what we heard at Vox was very, very compelling.
Yeah. Well, if it's an opera with the devil in it, you want to see it, right? You want to see him.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great character. And, you know, I think also the Norwegian aspect is kind of interesting, too.
And he's not a human devil, though. He's actually portrayed as a...
Well, he's a centaur in the current version.
Oh, that's right.
He started out as a satyr, and now he's a centaur. Centaur is a half-human horse kind of thing. And the satyr is kind of like a goat man. The whole big thing is Marin is comparing him all the time to this horse that she loved as a child. And there's all this horse terminology that Royce uses. Yeah, I mean, he went to horse camp and he knows all about horses.
Yeah.
At the time, I was like, what are the withers? You know, what's a... We just added a new line. He said, when he foundered, because that's like what happens to horses. Sometimes they founder.
It's like a verb specifically for horses.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. That's one thing that I really like about Royce's work in general is like his level of detail is so, you know, like that idea that he says that he gets a lot of his ideas for operas just by being on Wikipedia, you know, somebody who's always seeking out these detail-oriented things, you know.
His language is very poetic without being overly, it's enough to where it gives you some nice words to hold on to.
Yeah.
But it's not overly cumbersome. Yeah.
Right. That's what it is, cumbersome, yeah.
It's always going somewhere. Like each line leads to another line, which leads to another line. And, I mean, I was telling Royce, I think, one time that it's almost sometimes I want to cut something just because of maybe scansion stuff, rhythm things.
Mm.
And it's so hard because everything is so tightly interwoven.
It's not like a libretto for like a Rossini opera where you can just cut the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So when you were writing this, were you writing for with specific singers in mind?
I started out, you know, very ignorant about voice types and I was just kind of writing whatever kind of melodic lines I thought sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, during this workshop, I've been repitching a lot of things to fit more specific voice types. Because there's also some disparities in earlier where I thought one character would be a mezzo or something, and then like later it turned into a soubrette or something. I'm like, okay, I have to go back and make a choice. Like, what
is
she?
Yeah, that's a big choice, yeah.
Is this your first opera?
This is basically number two. I wrote The Hunger Art with Royce. In 2007, which is a 25-minute opera.
The Hunger Art. Does it have anything to do with The Hunger Artist, the Kafka story?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really?
A combination of that with the Adam and Eve story, and we did it through American Lyric Theater's Composer Librettist Development Program, and that was actually like our final project was everyone had to do an Adam and Eve story mixed with something, and so Royce found this Hunger Artist story, and he's like, why don't we, you know...
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah, that sounds good. I got to find that.
So do you feel like you've really sort of bit the opera bug now and that this opera makes you want to do more?
I think, it's strange because I started composing maybe 1994, and I mostly wrote piano stuff. But the whole time, I really liked lyric music, and it always came out in all my pieces. They always had some kind of lyric melodies or something, but I just never wrote for voice. It was very alien to me. I kind of didn't understand it. I don't know. It just didn't speak to me. And then more recently, maybe around 2005, I wrote some songs. And then once I did this opera program, I was kind of like, wow, this is really makes sense with my music. The multidimensionality and the challenge is really attractive, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
not
text,
that other kinds of music aren't, but it's just there's something special about that. It's theatrical. You're involving, you know, theater people and directors, and it's just very interesting in that regard. And it's a good medium for the quote-unquote classical composer.
I know you're in the middle of dress rehearsals and things, so thank you so much, Jeff, for coming and talking with us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Have a good show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
See ya.
See ya.
Hopefully you can edit something together from that. And it was kind of like the the wackiest one we've ever done.
I liked it. It was chatty. Well, it's a really interesting project. Another thing to keep your eye out for. Hopefully.
I liked that work a lot. That box. I mean, it did stand out to me.
Yeah.
That we heard. You know, even though it's still being developed, it was exciting. You know.
So now we're going to sign off this podcast. Hopefully, I'll have another one coming out soon. One to celebrate Pride. So hopefully, I'll have something to put out before the end of the month. And what else? Again, I just want to mention, if you're interested in singing in the West Village Summer Sing Series, go to our website, and I'll be doing a thing with opera choruses. It's going to be a lot of fun, and that'll be on the 28th.
Yeah, if you're a person who doesn't know if they like opera, I always think if you sing a little bit of it, if you're into some choruses, you'll know. You'll know if you like it. It's a different thing to do it. You know, you listen in a different way.
Yeah, and it's also hard to perform in an opera chorus because, first of all, music's memorized.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got all that other stuff going on, you know, the lights and the running around. And
usually you've got somebody screaming in your ear or both ears.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And I like to, as a conductor, I like to really warm them up with acting stuff too, because as a opera performer in the chorus, you're not just a singer. I mean,
nope.
you have to be really well-rounded. So I like to do lots of physical warm-ups, stuff like that.
Like punch him in the stomach and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's no, what it is.
Mean. I know what you mean, yeah.
You've worked with me. Did I ever punch? I've never punched anybody.
No, you never punched me in the stomach.
Not externally. I may have thought about it.
Right, right. That's okay. That's allowed.
So once again, I want to encourage you to, I mean, you know, public radio is doing all that begging for money this month.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that every show, it's like, please.
Yeah, you should give it. You should give it to us though, because we're indie, and they, you know, they exaggerate how much they need it.
Well, yeah. We need it too, though we're surviving without any money whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need it because, you know, I would love to get a faster server and be able to put more time and put these out faster. You know, someone should give us a couple $1,000s.
Mm-hmm. Somebody really likes opera.
Yeah, let's put out a challenge. A challenge.
$1,000 challenge, yeah.
Yeah, and whoever that is, maybe we'll find something to give them.
Yeah, maybe they could perform their favorite aria with you at the keyboard on our podcast.
That's interesting. I'd do that.
Isn't that a good one?
I'd do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe they could make us find a singer to sing their favorite aria.
Okay.
Something like that. Well, all right, that's all from this edition of the Indie Opera Podcast.
Yeah, and thanks for listening.
Thanks.